Welcome to the Bioethics Podcast. I'm Matthew Epinette, Executive Director of the Center for Bioethics and Human Dignity at Trinity International University. In this episode of the podcast, CBHD research analyst Heather Zeiger has a wide-ranging interview for us. I'll let her introduce the guest, but you're going to want to give this a close listen. In the interview, they cover forensic genetics, integrating into the criminal justice system, DNA and biometric samples like facial recognition, ethnic tagging in closed-circuit TV, and more. Balancing freedom and security, business ethics, research ethics, informed consent, and much, much more. As I say, this is a wide-ranging interview. Before I turn it over to Heather, though, as you may know, April marks the end of our fiscal year here at CBHD. I'm very grateful for each and every gift and each and every giver over the course of the last 12 months. Our budget for this year is just under $200,000, and we are very close to closing what was a significant gap only a few weeks ago. As I record this, we need $12,000 to fully close that gap. So far in 2024, bioethics has been pretty prominent in the news cycle. IVF, of course, has been all over the headlines following the February ruling by the Alabama Supreme Court regarding IVF embryos and that state's Wrongful Death of a Minor Act. We've highlighted a number of resources from our website and produced new content addressing this important issue. Assisted suicide hasn't made the same headlines, but in 2024, more than 20 states have considered legislation that would either legalize or expand previously legalized assisted suicide. Here, too, we've both highlighted existing resources and produced new ones in response. And just this month, we released the latest issue of Dignitas, our online, open-access, peer-reviewed publication. This issue is a themed issue focusing on what it means to be human. In the issue, we introduce a new-to-us feature, target articles and peer commentaries. This allows us to dig even deeper into the discussion of bioethics issues. The entire issue is available on our website, cbhd.org. You can read it there online, or you can download a PDF and read it offline. And this is only a very small slice of the work that we do, thanks to the generosity of people just like you. If you're able, please help us to close the remaining $12,000 gap by visiting cbhd.org and clicking on the donate button at the top of the homepage. Thank you in advance. And now, over to Heather.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of the Bioethics Podcast. My name is Heather Zeiger, and I'm a research analyst with the Center for Bioethics and Human Dignity. Today, we will be talking about the ethics of using gene sequencing technologies, most of which are produced by U.S. companies, for the biometric surveillance of minorities in China, especially those in the Xinjiang Uyghur Autonomous Region and the Tibet Autonomous Region. Joining me is Yves Moreau, a computational geneticist at the Catholic University of Leuven in Belgium. He was recently profiled in Nature for his work in holding research journals accountable for publishing studies based on the collection of biometric data, including this genetic data, from vulnerable populations and oppressed groups. In November, Yves won an award from the Einstein Foundation in Berlin for promoting quality and transparency in research, and for his work advocating ethical standards in the collection of human DNA. Yves, thank you for joining the Bioethics Podcast.
Heather, thank you so much for the invitation.
I think the first question, just to help some of our listeners, so we're a bioethics group, which means I have some scientists, I have some philosophers, I have pastors, I have people, lawyers, many different disciplines here. So let's help some folks out here with how is China's genetic database different from the genetic databases that the United States and the UK are building? I mean, for example, the US, they have a law that they passed not too long ago that allows police to use DNA that they've collected when they're booking perpetrators to then go into a national database. The UK has its own database. How is China's different?
All right, two things. The first thing is just to make it clear that when we talk about genetic databases, there are different kinds of databases. Here we're talking about what we call forensic genetics, so genetics for law enforcement. Next to that, there is also a huge field of biomedical genetics, where the situation is really quite different, where the risk, of course, of leakage between the two is also a point of concern. But what I focus on is what we call forensic genetics. The key difference that we see in how this technology is developed in China, in the UK, in the US, in Europe, well, it's from the point of view of China, it's really about the rule of law. I mean, how are such DNA databases integrated in the legal system and what safeguards are present? For example, if we compare continental Europe and even the UK with the United States, there are really important differences on how the rule of law is implemented. In Europe, the key standards is your profile will stay in the database if you've been sentenced for a serious offense. In the US, the standard would be that you have been arrested or sentenced for a serious offense. There's a really substantial difference. And from a European perspective, the US standards is kind of surprising. So it's really about how do we embed such a powerful technology, which is very useful, which helps solve major crimes, into a criminal justice system? What are protections that are offered to individuals who may have committed crimes or misdemeanors or might be innocent? And how does that all work together? And what we're mostly seeing in China is the lack of safeguards and also a very intense deployment across the entire country, but then also with a specific focus on certain ethnic groups like the Uyghurs, the Kazakhs in Xinjiang, or the Tibetans in Tibet. So it's really the safeguards. It's really about what happens if the police starts approaching you. Who does the police try to track or could try to track? I mean, there's really a lot of different issues here. In China, if you come up in front of a court, the conviction rate is 99.97% or something like that. So once you're in front of a judge, it's game over. And so the basic principles of human rights safeguards, of protection of privacy that are recognized in international human rights standards are simply not present in China. That doesn't mean that there are not problems elsewhere. There are important issues regarding the deployment of DNA databases in the US, for example, the fact that asylum seekers on the US-Mexico border have been in the past put in the national DNA database, the fact that there are poorly regulated local DNA database at the city level, New York City being a prime example, that have raised concerns in the past. Same thing in the UK, where basically an important legal decision led to actually the limitation of collection of DNA profiles. The basic idea is really a balance between two core perspectives. One would be to say, well, just put everyone in the database. Then if you commit a crime, we'll find you. That is true. But the cost of doing that is significant to personal freedom. It's really putting you in a position that you're considered from the day you're born, because that would happen at birth eventually, that you are a potential criminal. And we've seen, for example, in the UK or some places in the US where, you know, minors were in trouble, the police would say, oh, let's collect their DNA, you know, because we know that someday they'll give us serious trouble and we want to have that profile in that case. So basically, there are fundamental differences between how DNA databases are deployed in China and in the US, UK, or elsewhere in Europe. It's basically, you know, free open societies with a rule of law and very authoritarian, autocratic society where there are serious human rights issues. But the problem of reckless deployment of DNA databases, that's present everywhere in the world.
Yes, thank you for clarifying that. I've noticed in some of my writing on China that often, so in any country, you're trying to balance freedom and security. And in China, that balance is heavily skewed towards security at the expense of freedom. So we run into problems of with criminals where you're getting your DNA collected or you are presumed to be a criminal just based on your features or your ethnicity, or for any number, you were involved in a protest that the authorities did not like, or things like that. And so it is a heavy weight towards security, so much so that it does away with freedom. And I think in some of the European countries, the United States, places like that, we try to work that balance a little bit more in democratic countries.
Also, I want to say that when we balance safety versus freedom, often once the trade-off gets towards safety, it's at the expense of the freedom of the other. It's really like nobody wants themselves, their family or their friends to be, you know, sent to prison or in the case of Xinjiang and Tibet to camps on a whim. Nobody wants that. When we say, oh, we have to ensure stability, ensure safety, therefore we will balance safety and freedom differently, I think there is a place for that. I think there is are significant cultural differences between people in China, in Europe, and the United States. Europe and the United States are significantly different. But when it starts to weigh a lot, usually it's on certain groups. So in China, it could be ethnic groups that are perceived as problematic because the risk of demands for autonomy or even separatism, Xinjiang, Tibet, religious groups, the Falun Gong, the Christian minorities, groups that most of us would consider socially problematic, sex workers, drug addicts. Usually when we say, yes, we want to guarantee safety, it's okay to give up some freedom, the burden, when it really gets harsh, that is on some smaller groups. And then people say, yeah, it's okay, that's how we do it. No, that's how we, the majority, are okay doing it against the minority. But if you ask the minority, they're really not happy about that. And I think that needs context, because I think that there is space for some cultural differences in this balance, but it cannot be totally extreme. Everybody wants their basic human rights to be respected.
So just to help some of our listeners, and we'll have more information on this in the show notes. So since around 2014, the Chinese Communist Party, and particularly the local government in Xinjiang, that's where I've focused most of my writing, but also Tibet has had similar problems. They've engaged in this massive surveillance campaign, and they've focused on Turkic minorities, including Uyghurs. Several countries in the last few years have denounced the Chinese government, calling their actions crimes against humanity, and even accusing the government of genocide. A lot of this came out in the news during the 2022 Winter Olympics. So a lot of people have said, what's going on in Xinjiang? That is a, you know, Orwellian massive surveillance campaign. And yet it also, we should pay attention to this both for the human rights reasons and because this can be exported to other authoritarian governments. What are they doing so far as collecting DNA samples, genetic samples, any kind of biometric samples? What is going on that you know of in places like Xinjiang? I know that there's surveillance in the rest of the country, but there's something particularly escalated among the Uyghurs in Xinjiang.
So what we know for rather certain, because we have a global picture that you assemble from little touches here and there, but there are things that we know quite clearly. What I know regarding DNA databases is that in 2015, 2016, the police forces in Xinjiang purchased up to 40 DNA sequencers, which is a massive number. There's only 25 million people in Xinjiang. If you wanted to do normal police work, you may need one or two sequencers, one in Urumqi, one in Kashgar, and that should be pretty much enough. There were already 20 DNA labs across Xinjiang, which is a very remote region. I mean, it's a big desert with some mountains. It's a wonderful place. It's a wonderful place to see, but it's a very remote place in China. So why this intensity? On top of that, there were guidelines, official documents that stated that a collection, systematic collection of DNA samples from all citizens 12 to 65 should be carried out. Now, what of that plan exactly got carried out, we don't know, because the protests came out, the whole Xinjiang issue was brought in the foreground in 2019-2020. That had an impact. So what I know is that there's at least 4 million DNA profiles from people from Xinjiang in the national DNA database, so at least 15% of the population, which might actually be very biased towards Uyghurs and other Muslim minorities or not. We don't know, really. So it might be more like for the minorities, 25% or more people are in that national DNA database. They might also be in that we don't know very well. It might also be that more samples have been collected and they might be in a local provincial DNA database, or they might be in storage to be processed, but then never got fully processed. We don't know very well. We know that there is a large number of sequencers, much more than normal police efforts would justify. And we know that guidelines were published to collect systematically from the entire population. What actually happened, that I don't know for a fact. That needs to be brought together with all the other modalities of surveillance. So facial recognition, so cameras everywhere, facial recognition, we know that is well documented, that software for cameras was written to track people based on ethnicity. So there was ethnic tagging in video feeds. That is a product that is available from several camera vendors. We know that software got installed on mobile phone to track for illegal content, which might be a copy of the Quran. We know that people could be punished and sentenced to camps for things like having a beard that's too long and too Islamic looking. So you should see that piece of the surveillance infrastructure as one piece out of a much more global picture. They have even tried self-driving cars with cameras roaming the streets. So it goes really far. And Orwellian is actually a very meaningful word for what has been deployed in Xinjiang.
So at least at the time, and I believe U.S. companies are still some of the biggest providers of genetic sequencing machines. And I believe the United States still leads that. And Thermo Fisher Scientific is the largest company that provides DNA sequencing technology. In the past, you have called them out for selling technology to Xinjiang. Can you tell us, is Thermo Fisher still selling to that province in China? And I've read some other companies, some other U.S. companies have sold to Tibet, to other authorities. What is the update on that?
Yeah, so the situation right now for Xinjiang is that following the publication of all that information about the purchases and the supply, and the fact that Thermo Fisher and some other companies like Promega were playing an important role in this supply, there was a pushback, legislative pushback, so administrative pushback. So export controls were set up that would prevent the sale of those technologies to the police in Xinjiang. Then we figured out later that these sanctions were being worked around and there was still a supply of that technology. I think that led to serious pressures. And my belief is that currently there is no more systematic flow of that technology to the police of Xinjiang. The export controls is a very strong type of regulation, because not only does it prevent you from selling the product to a certain entity or a certain country, it actually obliges you to set up due diligence to prevent that your product ends up with that customer. And you cannot say, I didn't know. You have to say, well, these are the measures that I put in place. This was the best I could do. And if, you know, something still makes its way to the customers, then maybe you can defend yourself. But you cannot just say, well, you know, I didn't sell directly and I sold it to someone else and they shipped it to them. What can I do? That's not a proper defense. So I think it's a very strict type of regulation. And I think it has some significant impact, not sure, you know, it's absolute, but it's very significant. When I started looking into Xinjiang, while maybe the focus was originally for people to say, well, this is abusive on the part of the Chinese authorities, which it absolutely is, what I immediately thought, maybe because I'm an engineer, I thought, well, why are you selling so much of this technology to this type of player, to this type of entity? And in 2017, when I started looking into the problem, I said, well, you have to put pressure on the suppliers. That may not solve entirely the problem, because they're also, to some extent, Chinese suppliers for the kits, so that you have the machines and you have the kits, a bit like an inkjet printer where you have the printer and the cartridges. These are two closely related markets. Thermo Fisher was the dominant player in both. For the kits, the cartridges, if you want, there was also national suppliers, but the machines, that was very strongly dominated by Thermo Fisher. So it did seem like a very powerful leverage to go after the supply. Now, of course, with the years, you know, technology advances, capacity building is set up. And so it might be a bit less true now than 5 years ago. But this was a very important leverage to limit the supply of the technology, but also to open the debate. Because when you start regulating in this way, you're pointing your finger at a problem and you're saying, we have a problem here. What are we going to do about it?
Yes. So we're talking about genetic DNA sequencers, but I think that this has a broader application to business ethics in general. And of course, there's lots of other types of technologies that maybe have been developed in the US or in Europe that are being sold in China. And I wonder if this application for genetic technologies has a broader implication for providing other types of technologies to certain entities in China. And I think,
yes,
go ahead.
So regulating the international behavior of corporation is really one of the main ways forward for our civilization. I mean, it's really a civilization issue. Companies can get away with a lot less in their own country. If they start selling very dangerous products in a reckless manner, something will happen eventually. Here we have a situation where we say, well, when you say sell it abroad, you know, we're not going to ask too many questions. I think that there is really space for better ethics of business and better regulation, because of course you cannot always decide what the rules exactly are. So for example, for an American business operating in China, well, you still have to abide by Chinese law or decide to get out of the Chinese market, which is an option. Google moved out of the Chinese market for a long time because they thought that they could not operate in a meaningful way in the Chinese market. But you also have your home country. So what is, I think, acceptable is to say, oh, I'm a company, I'm a US company. When I operate in the US, I have to abide by US law. And when I operate abroad, I can completely forget about US law. I think that is not the proper way to do it. And I think it's a manageable system. What you want to avoid is every country claiming, you know, jurisdiction on every action of every company. That's not that cannot work. But if you say, well, you have to abide by the rules of the country in which you operate, and you might decide that there is no way for you to operate ethically under those conditions, and you have to operate by the rules of your home country, I think there is a workable system that could be built. Now, can we legislate that? Well, that's going to be difficult. It's work for the UN. It might take 30 years, 50 years, a century or more. Eventually, I think we'll get there because it's so meaningful. But for companies, we can also ask them to behave ethically, and we can have a look and shine a light on that behavior. So usually companies will say, well, we sell products, and yeah, we intend to do well, we intend those products. I mean, these are really products that normally have a lot of positive values. They are meant to help solve crime. So these are really important products. You cannot say, well, I'm selling my products and then I'm just forgetting about what my customers do. So what is the rationale here precisely? Because it's a difficult question. People tend to say, well, once I've sold something, well, it's not my responsibility, I cannot control. And I think that that is partly true, but we have to be a little more careful. So let's imagine just a kitchen knife. Okay, I sell kitchen knives, and some guy came to buy a kitchen knife, and it turns out that 6 months later, this guy killed his wife with a knife. Do I hold responsibility for this? Well, no, I don't. I could not reasonably have foreseen what would happen. Now, if the same guy bursts into my shop screaming that his wife is cheating on him and he wants the biggest knife that I have in my store, then I should think twice about selling that knife. I mean, it's the basic concept of liability, and it requires two core elements that are the first one, that what you contributed was essential to the events that took place. You know, you sold the knife. Yeah, that was in the chain of events an important element. And second, that the outcome was reasonably foreseeable. That is the core element. So saying, you know, I'm selling a product, then I don't have responsibility anymore, that is true in general. It is not true in specific situations. So I think there, for example, the volume of the sales by Thermo Fisher should have alerted the Thermo Fisher people that something unusual was happening. Oh, why are they suddenly buying in one go like a dozen sequencers? You know, why would they need that? I think that should have been the red flag that would have triggered due diligence, and then they would have read the news, and then they would have said, this looks concerning. The persecution of the Uyghurs did not start in 2016-17 when those, or 15-16, when those sales that I noticed took place. It started much earlier. So if you have people operating in the country who are familiar with the cultural background, who read the news, you will find that. And then you would say, okay, if we think that there is a risk of abuse of our products, what should we do now? How should we regulate that? For example, you could say, well, I'm not going to sell you that much. You know, I think that a reasonable quantity is this much, and that's what I'm willing to sell you per year, and I'm not going to sell you more. So there are ways. And the question is, do companies, multinationals, have an ethical responsibility? And I would strongly say yes. There is not just the duty to shareholders to maximize profits, that is actually not a correct perception of the business responsibilities. And there's certainly some duties to respect basic ethical principles within a framework of business. We don't expect, you know, businesses to behave like saints. They are profit driven. That's part of life. But once you realize that your product, which you know beforehand, can be abused. I mean, you know that this is not your average product. It's not like you're selling a bottle of water. I mean, with a bottle of water, you could drown someone to death, but this is not the first thing that comes to mind. With a knife, you'd say, well, I can imagine that. And with these products, you'd say, well, we have to worry. I mean, people have been warning about potential risks of abuse of DNA databases before. And in particular, as soon as Thermo Fisher was specifically alerted when Human Rights Watch wrote to them, they could have taken faster measures to deal with the problem. It's only after a lot of pressure, after 2 years of pressure that built up in the US, in Congress, that they started to do something. Actually, between the period of 2017-2019, I think they have a very severe and serious responsibility that is well established, because they received the letters. They cannot say, we didn't know, and they didn't do anything for another 2 years.
Yeah. To me, this is not unreasonable at all. Like in my area of chemistry, if you order a bulk amount of certain chemicals, that's always red flagged. I mean, it just
Yes, exactly.
And it's not. And so they check on you, and that's just the case. I mean, this isn't something that is an unreasonable expectation of a company when they sell a product that could have a dual use.
Yes, yes. Chemicals are a very good example. We know that chemicals blow up. We know that chemicals can be transformed into, you know, gas weapons. And we know that they can be used to manufacture drugs. So, of course, this is well established in chemistry, and this is no different from elsewhere. What is the real difference? It's essentially, I think, that in chemistry, things blow up. And that got people's attention in the beginning of 20th century when things started blowing up everywhere. And then it happened still, you know, Bhopal. And I think for chemistry, well, chemists know you cannot, you know, discount the risk. They're very real and it really happens. And I think that that's basically that mindset of knowing that the risks is real. It's not something that is a fidget of the imagination of someone, it is real. And so I think that surveillance technology doesn't have that thing of blowing up in your face to the same extent. And for that reason, we tend to be less concerned about it, while the impact on societies is very real and very tangible. In Xinjiang, in Tibet, and everywhere in China, there is really a lot of surveillance. And it does induce increased compliance. And of course, you can say, well, it's good that people comply with the rules, but it also quickly becomes a system where compliance is actually just to keep you in place and avoid you talking about things that authorities don't like. And that is a risk everywhere. It's not only in China. It's a risk in the United States. It's a risk in Europe. So as societies, how do we balance all these risks?
So we've kind of touched on a topic I want to get into, since this, what you're saying, is actually hitting the topic of research ethics and informed consent, which is an important part of research ethics. So the other side of this is the research that's being published from the DNA that's collected from forensics, for example. And I believe I was looking up the statistics here, and I believe over the last 5 years, you and your team have flagged some 96 papers that raise ethical questions about the genetic database that was used to publish those papers, because they are specifically using data that they acquired from minority groups like the Uyghurs or Tibetans, where the idea, where it's very, there's a lot of questions as to whether true informed consent was given to use that genetic data. So of those 96, by the way, I believe 12 have, or only 12 have been retracted so far, which is another.
No. We had 18, 18 recently extra. So we're 29 now.
Okay, 29. Very good. So can you tell us a little bit about that project of holding journals to account? So this is the research side of things. We've been talking business ethics. Now we're kind of talking about research ethics. And also the big question I had was, why are these journals so slow about retracting these papers?
Yes. So how did this question of research ethics come about? So I was focused first on the role of the suppliers. That was the first thing. And then I basically came across the fact that there had been a couple, not a lot, but there have been some publications between suppliers like Thermo Fisher and Chinese Public Security on refining developing kits for the Chinese market. So really red flag work that drew my attention. And basically what happens when you develop a DNA database technology or human DNA identification technology is you create a kit that looks at a very minute fraction of the human genome, about a millionth of our genetic information, and do that in a way that identifies the intrinsic essential genetic characteristic, a genetic profile of an individual, for example, to recognize that two DNA samples must come from the same person, and do that with a very, very high degree of certainty. There are a few variations on the technology, but the first one is just identification of exact matches. Well, basically, when you say I have a sample from a crime scene and I have a suspect and I test and I see that those two profiles are identical, then you will hear, you know, favorite CSI episode, the chance of that happening is one in a billion, 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 if the two people are unrelated, the two samples are not family related. That number is the result of a statistical analysis that is population dependent. So if you take the same match in the Chinese population, in the US general population, in the US white or US black population, you get a different numbers every time. I mean, not that it's minute and then it's strong, but the orders of magnitude vary significantly. So you want to do this analysis correctly. So for an analysis, you have to calibrate your kit to a particular population in which you want to use it. So when a supplier comes up with a new kit on the market, researchers will ask, okay, but they claim that this is working well. We want to double check that. So let's take a couple populations. Let's do a DNA profiling analysis. Let's look at the statistical properties and let's see whether the kits behave as advertised. And also, often what they do is they compare populations. They try to show that, for example, the Uyghurs are closer to the Kazakhs than they are to the Han Chinese, or the Tibetan are more different from the Uyghurs than from the Han, things like that. And that's a typical paper. The surprising thing is that it's a huge pipeline from products to research and the other way around. It's over 1,200 papers in the literature that take one or more Chinese ethnic groups, profile it using a kit, and then report about that. And there, in there we see an intense focus on certain ethnic groups. To give an idea, in a set of about 500 publications that I looked at in more details, there was about one out of five publications was mentioning Uyghurs in some way, data from Uyghurs in some way. Not necessarily primary collection, but that the data of Uyghurs had been used to do some calculation in that paper, while the Uyghurs are only 1% of the population in China. For the Tibetan, it was one in six papers studying Tibetans, while they only are 0.5% of the Chinese population. So there was an incredible disproportion between how big these groups are in the Chinese population and how much research is being done. Now, you can argue that the Uyghurs are interesting because there is this admixed population. They are really in between the Eurasian, Caucasian populations and the Han Chinese population genetically, because they're a result of the flow of populations. The Tibetans are fascinating because of the adaptation to high altitude, which is reflected in their genetic background. But the proportion seems to me like not normal. It's really very, very surprising. And I think it reflects a mindset of mapping. You want to map all the details of all the populations with all the different technologies. You want to know more. And that mindset, well, first of all, is very close to a law enforcement mindset, you know, see everything. It has also, without accusing Chinese authorities of colonialism in certain ways, but it is really reflective of a colonial mindset. If you want to colonize a territory, you want to know everything about it. You want to map it. And so I think these dimensions show that this kind of research is potentially extremely dangerous because it can be part of the development and deployment of dangerous technologies that can be used to control and persecute populations. Nobody can, once they you point that to people, they cannot step away and say, no, no, that cannot be true. It is really clear from the research that can be deployed. And so this focus on these groups is very surprising. And then you ask, okay, but this is research. So when we publish research in Western journals, we have to abide by well-established human research standards. This is nothing new. These are very well-established principles, and there are a number of ethical dimensions that we need to respect. One dimension is autonomy, meaning that participants should be free to participate or not to participate in a research that is mostly embedded in free informed consent. The other part is actually all the other ethical dimensions, non-maleficence, don't hurt people, first do no harm in biomedical research, benevolence, justice, you know, when there are risks and benefits, it should not be one group gets all the risks and another group gets all the benefits. So these basic ethical principles and also autonomy should be further guaranteed by the ethics committee. So an ethics committee will look at your project proposal, and it's its duty to assess whether the research that you propose meets those ethical principles. And if it not, demand that you either adapt your research or just not carry out the research. And so obviously here there is a huge problem regarding China, because actually, although this kind of research clearly shows important risks and therefore it's very concerning from a basic ethical standard, it is something that is totally accepted by Chinese authorities, and that trickles down to ethics committees at universities. We sometimes saw totally surreal things, like research that was approved by the ethics committee of the Ministry of Public Security or by the ethics committee of the Ministry of Justice. So you can have, I mean, there's not a lot of examples, but you can have situations where you have researchers from the body that persecutes an ethnic group approving their own research. That is crazy. Then the second dimension is, and this is what something that the publishers are willing to consider to some extent, is the notion of consent. Now, consent, it's three things. It's free informed consent. There needs to be some kind of documentation that indeed people consented. Now, I think that to some extent, the focus was on, it was there a paper that was signed by someone? But that's not at all what free informed consent is. Free informed consent has just two main parts. Informed, you should disclose all the relevant information. So if you have, for forensic genetics research, which has a clear risk component, if you tell to people, are you okay to participate in research? And are you okay to participate in research to help solve crimes? That is not proper informed consent, in particular in ethnic groups that are at risk. So there you should disclose, well, if you participate in this research, it is possible that that research may contribute in some, to some extent, in deploying technology used to control your community. And then you see that it's very, very different from saying, oh, do you want to participate in research to help solve crime? The second component is free. Free does not mean just that the consent was not collected under duress. It's a much higher standard. The standard is that people were free to choose or to participate or not in the research without any reasonable fear of retaliation. So we put that bar very high. For example, in biomedical research, if we want to use the data of patients, you cannot ask that before you provide diagnosis and treatment. You have to first do the whole diagnostic and therapeutic cycle. And then at the end, you may ask, okay, by the way, can I use your data? Because if you ask it up front, patients could reasonably fear, even if it is not what would actually happen, they could reasonably fear receiving a lower standard of care if they decided not to cooperate. So that bar is very high. When you put these things together, and you imagine DNA that is collected by researchers possibly affiliated with law enforcement in a region where persecutions are actively taking place, you see that this does not make any sense. So for Xinjiang, for Tibet, I think that this problem of the meaninglessness of informed consent in those publications is very clear. I would even open it up and say, well, because the rule of law in China does not, because it exists, I mean, there is a legal process, not everything is completely arbitrary, but because there is a basic lack of safeguards, actually there is an issue for all Chinese populations. And it is, in my view, such that because we saw, when we looked at also this set of 500 publications, we saw that in every other publication, there was a co-author affiliated with the police, public security, or the Ministry of Justice or a similar institution like a police academy, a police college. Because of that complete enmeshing, this is part of the military-civilian fusion concept in China, this deep enmeshing of academic and law enforcement judiciary activities, you cannot separate that. And so I think the entire field has a huge problem. I think at the least, all publications involving public security or the judiciary and all publications targeting the most vulnerable groups, the Muslim minorities and the Tibetan groups, that all of that is ethically indefensible.
Thank you. That several things I was thinking as you were talking. One of those that I want to direct people to is the Nature article that we're going to link. They did interview a man who said that even if you see documentation where, and he is someone who is of the Uyghur ethnicity, even if you see signed consent form, he said, don't believe that that is free and informed consent. Nobody says no. So there, if you want to take a look at his interview, we're going to link the Nature article there, but he does not believe that you really are giving any free or informed consent.
Yeah, it is essentially impossible. I mean, you can be sent to a camp, or you could be sent to a camp because your beard was too long. I mean, you're going to decline participating in data collection where there might be a police officer present. It doesn't make any sense.
Right. And the vocational training schools, as the euphemistic term that the authorities like to use, these camps are already outside of the law. So there is no recourse there to say, well, they're asking me to do something that I am not consenting to. So this is already imprisoning someone for reasons that are beyond, that are outside of the law. So there's a huge problem there. And then, Eve, you brought up the problem of what I guess we can call conflict of interest with just the military and the research and police groups, and that's an issue. That's something that I think in a lot of places we try to avoid is severe conflicts of interest, particularly with ethics committees or institutional review boards. And so, yeah, there's several ethical issues with research ethics that come up here, so much so that publications have some kind of obligation to do their due diligence before publishing research. Yeah. Coming from certain groups.
Yeah. On top of that, I want to add that biomedical ethics has this very strong focus on the risks to the participants. That is because traditionally this is what it was about, because you want to test a new drug. If you have not done properly your homework, the risk to a participant could be substantial, and that is a risk that you want to avoid. You don't want to inject dangerous stuff to people. But in other fields like anthropology, sociology, it is also well recognized, and those are well-established principles, that a research could harm communities beyond the individual participants. And so here, I think this is a case where those standards that exist, they are part of the Declaration of Helsinki, for example, they're part of the SIAM's guidelines on human subject research. These principles of looking for risk of group harms should be taken into account. Your genetic profile is related, 50% with your children, 50% with your parents, 50% with your siblings, and then more broadly with your community. What you can try to do, for example, is predict ancestry, your ethnic origin from your DNA. These are things that are to some extent possible. So it's not just your DNA. It is your DNA. You need to have some control over it. But the use of your DNA impacts actually not just you, but also your family and your whole community. And so those dimensions are very rarely considered until now, while actually those principles exist. They're well established. They are like standard for an anthropologist or a sociologist. While in medical settings, and forensic genetics is kind of in the outskirts of biomedical research, there they say, well, no, it's about the participants. Yes, it's about the participants. It's also actually about the community. So yes, these issues, they are kind of obvious once you get your attention pointed to it. I mean, I can understand that for a while, you know, nobody was raising the issue so that this could have been missed. I can, you know, understand that it was not immediately obvious if you didn't know about the persecution of Uyghurs in 2015, you know, how would you have known? For example, the research on Tibetans, I find, you know, more surprising. We know that there are serious issues in Tibet. We know that there is social control. We know that for many decades. So why haven't people asked questions about the ethics of that type of research? I could understand that in 2017, people would say, well, I've never heard about the Uyghurs. Also, forensic genetics is a field that is specialized in ethnicities. So it looks at variations of genetics all across the world. So it's also not the average person not having heard of. It's actually people whose career is about looking at different groups. So you could expect also some degree of knowledge about, you know, the political structures or around those groups. And so once this was flagged, what was really surprising was that in many instances, publishers in particular, also, you know, editors might also be part of the issue, but in particular, publishers was very slow to react. That has been variable. Some publishers have reacted swiftly. Others have been truly uncooperative, and even some have declined, you know, have said, okay, we looked at your cases and we don't see any problem with those. So there's been a range, but overall, it has been extremely slow and very, very surprising that when you refer to basic notion of privacy, basic notions of ethical approval, people look at you as if they didn't understand what you're talking about and why you're making such a fuss. And again, we're not talking about, you know, the minuties of discrimination. We're talking about crimes against humanity. I mean, this is not, you know, oh, you know, we have different perceptions of the situation. We're talking about very, very serious situations. Now, you could say, yeah, but the persecution of Uyghurs, you know, how much of an element are DNA databases in those persecutions? And that's an interesting question, because in practice, you know, when you can send people to these camps just for about anything, well, why do you really need DNA databases? So that's a reasonable question to ask. Why do you need DNA databases? Anyway, if you decide to send them, you just send them. That's, you know, you write a couple of sentences in an Excel sheet and somebody gets sent to a camp. That has been well documented. So why DNA databases? And I think that it's part of this control system. It's part of an attitude of authoritarian law enforcement, and also in non-authoritarian country, I think we should always worry a little bit about it. It's also become a tool of intimidation. And that is one of the mechanisms of social control. It is that, well, not only does the police have your DNA, it also has your picture. It is in a database. It can be scanned, you know, and every time you pass by a camera, it can be scanned. Your mobile phone might be tracked, you know, the GPS coordinates might be sent once in a while, and that has also been documented to some kind of a database. We've seen reports of QR codes put next to doors of houses so that the police can just scan the QR code and get access to the police file for the people living there. And at that point, you realize, oh yeah, okay, it's just one of the tools that you use to screw, you know, to put the vice on this group, where the ultimate goal is compliance, is stop, you know, practicing your Muslim beliefs. You know, we might still have some kind of mosque, so that yes, there is a place, but you know, the faster you move away from this culture, your religion, your traditions, the faster you become like the Han Chinese, the better for everyone. And so while, you know, you can have a discussion about, you know, whether those persecutions amount to genocides, they certainly are crimes against humanity. And they are also very characteristic of an intense policy of cultural assimilation. And that is a very harsh practice, to take a group of people and say, well, actually, the way you're living, you're giving us trouble. Let's just get rid of that. Let's just spend 20 years. We'll send your kids to schools. We'll give them a proper education. And, you know, 20, 30 years from now, you'll have just forgotten that this all happened. And I think that is a central crime, and that should be recognized.
Yes, I completely agree. We're getting to the end of our time. You've given us some fantastic things to talk about, some important things to consider for those of us that are Christians, for things for us to consider when we're considering the dignity of all human beings. As always, I think good science is ethical science, and we appreciate the work that you've been doing to ensure that good science is being done and that it is respecting individuals that are involved and also making sure not to exploit minority groups.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Heather, for the invitation, the opportunity to bring my voice to the debate. Yes, thank you so much.
And if our listeners are interested in learning more, we're going to include a link in the show notes to the Nature article that was recently published that has a lot of this information in it, as well as some extra information on some of the journals that have been alerted to look at the ethical practices of some of the papers that they have already published. We're also going to link a opinion piece published in The Hill by Yves and Maya Wong that you might want to take a look at. It will touch on what Thermo Fisher has done. And we're going to link my article that was in our summer 2023 issue of Dignitas on a Christian response to Xinjiang.
That was CBHD research analyst Heather Zeiger interviewing Yves Moreau, professor of engineering at the University of Leuven, Belgium, doing research at the interface between artificial intelligence and genetics, focusing in particular on mass surveillance technology. Links to the articles Heather and Yves mentioned are in the show notes. You've been listening to the Bioethics Podcast, a project of the Center for Bioethics and Human Dignity, copyright 2024, all rights reserved. The Center for Bioethics and Human Dignity is a Christian bioethics research center at Trinity International University, exploring the nexus of biomedicine, biotechnology, and our common humanity. Our website, cbhd.org, has a wealth of materials on a wide range of bioethical issues. For more information about the center and to support the work of the center and projects like this podcast, please visit our website, cbhd.org. My name is Matthew Epinette, and I'm the executive director of the center. Thank you for listening to the Bioethics Podcast.